Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear about an effort to bring more civility to sports when it comes to referees. Officials have long been the target of abuse. Some have even left the job. Women's sports have become more popular, and so are sports bars that cater to the games and their fans. Being older brings experience, but it can also make you the target of bias when you look for work. It's illegal, yet age bias is a real problem. We'll have some tips on how to improve your chances. We'll learn about how bills that seem to have plenty of support sometimes fail in the state legislature. We'll also find out how some smaller communities are dealing with homelessness. Many lack the resources, including homeless shelters. And this year marks the centennial for one of the largest floodplain forests in the Midwest. Those stories and more coming up this hour right here on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A few years ago, the number of youth sports referees in Illinois nosedived. And the number one reason why refs were leaving? Verbal abuse from fans and coaches. Peter Midland reports in an effort to remind us referees are human too.
If you've ever played or even watched sports, this is probably a pretty familiar scene. A parent, coach, or fan yelling at a referee at a youth sports game. Maybe you've even yelled at a ref or two from the comfort of your own living room watching on TV. They're easy targets in their zebra striped shirts, but mistreating youth sports officials has real consequences for the kids who are there to play. Kurt Gibson is the director of officiating at the Illinois High School Association.
Our officiating numbers had dropped to a low point, and schools were really struggling to find officials to work all the games they had on their schedules.
Right as sports were ramping back up after COVID disruptions, IHSA had fewer refs than they'd had in at least a decade. For every 100 newly patched refs, 70 to 80 will be gone after their first few years.
The treatment they were receiving mostly from fans was the reason people were leaving.
That's why IHSA has been partnering with Officially Human for the past 2 years. Officially Human produces PSAs and training videos to ask fans and coaches to put themselves in a referee's shoes and whistle.
Sports fans, we cheer on our favorite teams at fields, gyms, arenas, and stadiums. But have you ever wondered what it's like to be a referee?
Brenda Hilton is the CEO and founder of Officially Human, and she says their PSAs and videos had to be deeper than please don't be a jerk. For example, their course for coaches asked them to consider the craft of officiating and think about why people become refs in the first place.
Each section kind of takes somebody along the journey of an official. So Ralph is the official in the video. How did Ralph become an official? He was an ex-athlete. He wanted to stay involved with the game. He's got a wife, 2 kids.
That's true for so many officials. Many played growing up, often through the college level, and Officially Human surveyed thousands of refs, and 70% said they do it for the love of the game. That's certainly the case for Jeff Carr. He's been refereeing football from 10-year-olds all the way up to the Big Ten for nearly a half century. He played college football, wanted to stay connected to the game he loved, and found that through officiating. And he puts a ton of work into his craft. It means going to seminars, watching film of his game, and seeing how coaches teach techniques and what he can watch for.
Going to practices and stuff with these schools and hear the way they're being coached and stuff gives you a whole different insight into the game.
Jeff Miles is another longtime referee, and his story is similar to the other Jeffs. He played and loved sports growing up and wanted to stay in the game. At first, it was about making some extra money, too, but for Miles, refereeing is also about giving back to his community, creating a safe and fun place for kids to play.
It has brought me great joy and comfort being able to be a referee and give back, whether it's to youth or adults, but it's a way of life for me now.
On top of helping kids, he says it helped him grow a lot as well.
You know, your preparation, being to the game an hour beforehand, dealing with your conflict resolution skills.
Those conflict resolution skills are crucial when fan or coach behavior gets out of hand. And unfortunately, he does see it a lot.
When the game's over, we still have to walk outside to our car. And sometimes that can be difficult. You're looking over your shoulder.
There are other challenges, too. They don't get paid much. For high school varsity games, Miles would make around $80 a game. When you have a referee shortage, sometimes they just don't have enough people. Sometimes inexperienced officials are forced to cover games they're not ready for, which can lead to mistakes. And then the officiating itself is difficult. At IHSA, the number of refs is starting to rebound. They've made several changes to make it easier to become an official and to give great refs recognition, but Kirk Gibson says their officially human partnership has played a key role. Because officials do play a key role. Youth sports can be really important in a kid's life, and without refs, there's no game. I'm Peter Medlin.
There it is, the best game touchdown.
The Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge is one of the largest blocks of floodplain forest in the U.S. It's a critical rest stop for migrating birds and a haven for fish and other wildlife. This year, the refuge celebrates its 100th birthday, and the Midwesterners who had the foresight to save it. Rachel Kramer has the story.
On a bluff above the Mississippi River in northeast Iowa, Billy Ryder Marlf sets up a tripod with a spotting scope. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist says the fall migration has just begun.
A lot of northern pintail here today. Some gadwall, some Canada geese, some green-winged teal.
The Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge stretches 260 river miles through Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. Off the main channel, there's a mosaic of backwater lakes and marshes, braided streams, wetlands, and floodplain forests.
You can get lost in the maze of islands, and there's so many places to explore.
The 240,000-acre refuge is divided into four districts. Kendra Pednault manages the McGregor District, which covers parts of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. She says their mission is to protect wildlife and their habitats. Still, Pednault says it hosts nearly 4 million annual visits. People come here to fish, hunt, hike, kayak, and birdwatch.
The only way, personally, I feel that people can protect things is if they love it, and they got to get to know it a little bit to love it and want to protect it.
Back in 1924, a group of passionate anglers and outdoor enthusiasts convinced Congress to establish the refuge on the Upper Mississippi.
It was a huge success to protect a really large area. And if we didn't have that protection on this place, it would look a lot different.
Spearheading the campaign was the fledgling Isaac Walton League of America and its first president, Will Dilg. He spent his summers fishing in the river's backwaters. Scott Kovarovics is the executive director of the conservation organization. Shortly after the league formed, he says Dilg and the other founders caught wind of a plan to drain wetlands along 300 miles of the Upper Mississippi River.
And this was something that to them was just inconceivable that it could take place. The damage that would happen to the environment, to outdoor recreation, to fish and wildlife was incredible. And Dilg conceived of an audacious plan.
They set out to create a federally protected refuge. The league expanded from the Midwest to 100,000 members across the U.S. in a matter of years. They led a massive letter-writing campaign to members of Congress and created a coalition with groups like the General Federation of Women's Clubs.
And historians point to this, that, you know, the league in this campaign did originate the template for the grassroots conservation movement that would follow.
The challenges facing the Upper Mississippi River are different today than a century ago. The weather now teeter-totters between drought and extreme flood events. When rain comes in sudden bursts, it can cause a lot of erosion. In northwest Illinois, Savannah District Manager Ed Britton pulls out a large book with aerial photos from 1975.
Many of these islands that used to be along the main channel, they're all gone now. They've eroded away.
These islands are important nesting sites for birds. They also slow down river currents, which support more diverse habitats for aquatic life. At this district and across the refuge, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, and other partners are rebuilding islands and trying to protect more shorelines. But Britton says they need more public buy-in. And he says most people aren't going to notice how the river has changed if they just pass over it on a bridge.
They don't know what's going on with these extreme floods. You can look out there now, there's a little bit of a remnant of an island left, and I don't think most people are aware of that. They're just not aware of what's happening to our river system.
Back in Iowa, Ryder Marlf recognizes a lot of challenges ahead, but he hopes that visitors will still get to experience the richness of the refuge 100 years from now.
Because it's just such a treasure, and there's so much to learn out there.
As the sun hangs low, more ducks and geese glide into the water to rest for the night. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
Quincy officials are itching to depart with Southern Airways Express. The city and passengers have been on the receiving end of unmet promises and unreliable service from the only airline that serves its small airport. But as Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson reports, a decision from the U.S. Department of Transportation could mean a fresh start for the city and the Quincy Regional Airport.
The sky outside of the Quincy Regional Airport is filled with the sounds of airplanes taking off. But what you won't see is the hustle and bustle of people inside the airport. Besides the faint echo of a TV, it's really quiet in here. The only passenger waiting in the lobby is 19-year-old college student Genesis Dixon.
This is my first time being here. I didn't even know this was the airport.
Dixon just flew in from Chicago. She's one of two people on her Southern Airways Express flight bound for St. Louis. It's her first time flying with the airline and in a small 9-passenger plane.
And so when they put me on a small one, I got a little shaky. I was like, I don't know about this, but I was like, I got this, so I flew on it, so it was good.
The airport's passenger problem is something Quincy Mayor Mike Trope thought would improve with Southern Airways Express, its essential air service provider. It didn't.
They actually will be lucky to hit 4,000 passengers this current year.
Not quite the 20,000 passengers the airline sold the city on. He says the airport hasn't even rebounded back to its pre-pandemic levels of 11,000 passengers a year.
We've got a private business in town that brings customers in. They actually bring more customers in on their private aircraft than some weeks of what we have with Southern.
The U.S. Department of Transportation contracts with airlines and pairs them with smaller community airports to prevent them from being left in the dust as major airlines prioritize larger cities. The department signed a 4-year contract with Southern to provide Quincy a total of 36 round-trip flights per week, split evenly between Chicago and St. Louis. The trade-off? Southern would get over $4 million in annual federal subsidies. Instead, Trope has been on the receiving end of frustrated passenger and travel agents' phone calls.
Hey, I had a flight. It was delayed. I missed my connection flight wherever in Chicago or St. Louis. You know, then you got to rebook everything, reschedule everything. You know, none of us that travel, I don't care if it's recreational or business, like to tolerate that.
The airline struck out with Quincy when a former Southern employee accused the airline of knowingly jeopardizing the safety of its passengers at a different airport. Southern Airways Express has denied these allegations. In a statement, its chief of staff said, "Our number one job at Southern Airways is to keep our passengers safe." In August, Trope sent a letter to the DOT asking to cut ties with the airline mid-contract. The department conditionally agreed to swap out the provider if a replacement is found. Until then, they're stuck with Southern. Austin Drucker is an economist at the Federal Trade Commission. He spent years researching the effectiveness of the EAS. It's not common to switch providers mid-contract, but it's not impossible either, Drucker says.
One of the things that the DOT must consider is the views of the community. So the airline is supposed to, one, have reliable service, like a proven record of reliable service, and they also have to take into the subsidy amount.
Trope is hopeful. He says the city has talked to 4 regional airlines and its previous EAS provider, Cape Air. Bottom line, Trope wants an airline that will do right by Quincy.
Safety and reliability. This is your schedule. You take off on time. You land on time. You deliver the people their luggage. All of those are the factors that are going to make successful, happy passengers.
Interested airlines will have to submit a proposal to the DOT by November 14th. In Quincy, I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson, St. Louis Public Radio.
You might have noticed rising turnover and declining morale in your workplace post-pandemic, part of a national trend recognized as the Great Exhaustion. 60% of the American workforce say they're moderately burned out or worse. Colin Shope spoke with a university professor of behavioral medicine and psychiatry, James Berry, about what's happening and how employers are responding.
People are exhausted. There is a lot of not only stress at work, of course, a lot of people also realize, geez, I'm spending more time at home than I ever did before, but I'm still just as exhausted, just as anxious, or just as depressed as I was spending time at work. This speaks to larger social factors that we are enduring right now as a nation, you know, such as the polarization of politics and other things, epidemic of loneliness.
Do we get here to this level of exhaustion in our workforce without the COVID pandemic, or was it absolutely instrumental in where we are now?
I would consider it as an accelerant. So I believe, and so my experience is in healthcare. And so I definitely had seen patterns that were getting worse up to COVID, at least in the healthcare field, and people leaving healthcare in large numbers that were concerning to me. And then COVID, of course, it blew everything out of the water.
Could you talk about the impact that burnout has on organizations, and then how these organizations are trying to handle that?
So very large numbers of people end up either leaving for long periods of time or leaving and not returning. And so you can imagine, if you are an employer and you've invested a lot of money to onboard a employee, do all the training necessary, you want to be able to keep this employee for as long as you possibly can and make sure that they are working to the top of their expertise and abilities, so that it's a win-win situation for the employee and for the employer, as well as whatever delivery of services the company is trying to provide. The other thing that is significant regarding burnout and the impact that it can have on a industry is the number of mistakes that people can make if they are burned out. One important strategy that I really communicate with my own team and my own system is get rid of the stupid stuff. What are things that our employees are doing that they just don't need to do and that they can do else? Because people find meaning and purpose in that stuff that they really enjoy and that they're good at. And we all have to do a certain degree of stupid stuff, but how do we minimize that degree of stupid stuff?
That's Professor of Behavioral Medicine and Psychiatry James Berry discussing what's known as the Great Exhaustion, and he spoke with Colin Shope. More ahead on Statewide. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Do older individuals face bias when it comes to getting a job? Stacey Haller is Chief Career Advisor for ResumeBuilder.com. The online service surveyed 1,000 hiring managers and found age bias exists for the most senior applicants and their counterparts in Generation Z. Maureen McKinney talked with her.
Your survey showed that 4 in 10 hiring managers have an age bias against Gen Z, and one-third admit to age bias against senior candidates. So which is really worse if you're trying to get a job?
I think what's worse is what we're seeing is everybody's having a bias against somebody in this hiring process. These numbers that you just shared, when I looked underneath it, it turns out that 63% of our respondents were between the ages of 25 and 44. So it looks like that cohort group is not hiring people younger than them or older than them. And that's really interesting. And this cohort are the folks that are first getting into management. So when I read this and I'm like, okay, so now we have the first year's early folks in their management career having a bias against the Gen Z. And we know there has been bias against Gen Z because they entered the workforce with skills that were not sharpened due to remote work. And since they started remote, when they got into the workforce, we've had many surveys, and you could read a lot on the internet about why folks are not interested in hiring Gen Zers, because they don't have the skills and organizations have not been prepared on how to train them and onboard them, understanding that. And we know there's been bias against older workers always. So when you say which is worse, I think they're both pretty bad. And I don't think age should ever be a requisite in terms of a requirement for anybody getting hired.
Isn't it true that there are laws against age discrimination?
Absolutely. 100% age discrimination is illegal. And some people have brought some cases up. Many times, though, you don't even know you're being age discriminated against, or you wouldn't know. It might not be obvious. You could be sending out many resumes and not getting called. Now, you might assume at some point it's age, but it's never in a place where you could actually prove it or have a case. So it is very difficult in that regard. And as hard as that is, it's very easy for people to discriminate about age, because we have seen from some of our other surveys that if a hiring manager really wants to know how old you are, they'll resort to looking up on Facebook or just looking other ways to see if they could determine. So yes, it's 100% illegal everywhere. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
The 1 in 3 said that elderly appearance is something that they'll use against a candidate?
Well, of course, my first reaction is it's amazing that people even admit to these things, honestly. And we've had other surveys just in general about how hiring managers feel about appearance, whether it might be somebody who is very overweight or very tall. And those appearance biases we know exist as well. Now, our survey that you're referring to, we did focus on senior candidates. If you're biased against older workers and you're doing a Zoom interview with someone and they appear elderly to you, or they're even showing, sometimes even not knowing the technology, that is not only relegated to seniors, by the way, but it does happen. And yes, that's all illegal too.
I'd imagine years of job experience would flag you as being older. Why does having an address listed, why does that flag you as older?
Because people don't mail you anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is done by mail. And there's another very good reason. It's another reason for bias. People mm-hmm. will judge you where you live. It's totally irrelevant. Nobody's mailing you anything. Nobody needs to know where you live. So we started eliminating street addresses off of resumes over a decade ago for those very two reasons. Just like a picture is not appropriate on a resume either, it just fuels bias and it's irrelevant as to whether or not you could be a great employee.
What does that mean for the person looking for a job?
And that really is the key. You know, for seniors, let's say, who are looking for work, and many of them, there's no retirement age anymore. There are more seniors that if they want to work, they have more opportunities, especially due to remote work. But it's important about how you go about that search, knowing that there is age discrimination out there. So that includes everything from on your resume, having an AOL address flags you as an older person. Having things like your street address on your resume, that no longer belongs there. And that also positions you as someone older. So just what's on your resume might indicate you're not current today. So it's very important on how a resume is structured. Graduation dates, no longer necessary. There's no reason that you need to have the date of your college degree or when you graduated. Just the fact that you have a degree. So those are some things that could eliminate some age bias. And then, of course, these folks need to stay up on top of the technology, show energy, show they're willing to learn, fight against what we know the biases are. And the younger generation, to fight their biases, they have to acknowledge that there are some skills that they will need going forward. And understanding how the process works a little bit better. So knowledge will help all the generations get through some of this bias as we kind of chip away, because clearly it's not helpful to anyone. And the more I see these surveys, I'm wondering who doesn't have a bias against them.
Who doesn't? Who is least likely to suffer from hiring manager's bias?
When I look at this survey and I see that the people who tend to feel this way and are carrying these biases are the, let's say, the late 20s to the mid 40-year-old managers, it looks to me like they're only hiring themselves then if they have biases on folks older or younger than them. But we also know within this group that there are other biases. People have race biases, sex biases. So it does make me wonder, with the proliferation of biases. And then the backlash to that was building diversity within organizations and paying attention to this. And unfortunately, the news later says sometimes we're moving away from it. So everybody needs to pay attention and focus on why we hire workers. It really is contingent on their skills, their experience, their ability to do the jobs, and factors that have no place in the hiring process just needs to be eliminated. I really think the importance is bringing this to everyone's attention. I think it's in some ways encouraging that we're talking about it so we could pay attention to it and work to eliminate it, where for many generations it wasn't spoken about. But today it's really in the forefront, and there's a hunt for talent out there. And if organizations want to attract and retain talent, they need to eliminate bias in their hiring process. And candidates need to be educated on how to fight it so they could end up working in the right company, in the right organization where they could flourish.
Maureen McKinney talking with career advisor Stacy Haller about age bias in the hiring process. Many Ukrainian Americans in Chicago are worried about what Donald Trump's return to the White House could mean for their home country. Anna Savchenko has more.
Marta Farian is with the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. She says Ukrainians fear Trump's win may mean a reduction in U.S. aid to Ukraine. There's also concern about statements Trump made about settling the war between Russia and Ukraine.
Now the question is, at what price for Ukraine? So Ukrainian Americans are worried that Ukraine will be forced into a deal that will compromise Ukraine's independence and territorial integrity. But Ukrainians will not accept capitulation.
Farian hopes Republican lawmakers will work with the Trump administration to offer Ukraine security assurances. I'm the Savchenko, WBEZ News.
Rural homelessness is a growing issue nationwide, and in central Illinois, most counties don't have the social services infrastructure to support people in need. Several counties don't have homeless shelters. Agencies say there is a growing need to build them as the homeless population continues to climb. In the meantime, staff are left to find Band-Aid solutions. Melissa Ellen spoke to the people on the front lines in the fight to end homelessness about how they make use of the little resources they have.
Livingston County is seeing an unprecedented rise in the number of people homeless or on the brink of it. Numbers hit a record high in recent months, with 30 people identified as homeless countywide. That includes men, women, and children. Deb Howard is the director of United Way in Livingston County. She says there aren't enough resources for people to get back on their feet.
This has kind of become like an epidemic, where we definitely need something. I don't know what the answer is, but we need something.
Part of the problem is that Livingston County doesn't have a homeless shelter. Neither do most of the rural counties in the region, and it's becoming a strain on their already limited resources to find innovative ways to help people without them. Howard says Livingston County used to have no trouble sending people to other counties if a homeless shelter was needed.
And now we are, because they have their own issues.
Bloomington's two shelters have been full for months. Matt Burgess is the CEO of Home Sweet Home Ministries, which operates the Mission Shelter. He says Bloomington is lucky to have the homeless services network that it does. Most small cities and towns are like Pontiac, with few people able to support the homeless community.
The reality is there just aren't enough resources to have smaller shelters in all of the little towns in the rural area. It's just such a costly way of trying to provide support to people.
Caroline McLeese with Salvation Army Pontiac 360 Life Center says it may be the best option right now. She's starting to keep close track of the people in Livingston County who are homeless in the hopes of generating convincing data for people who are skeptical that rural homelessness exists in the area.
Nobody keeps track of these people, and that's my goal. I'm starting to keep track. I want to report this. I want to let everybody know this is what's going on. This is what we need help with. And I'm just hoping out of that, somebody's going to say, I'll help you.
The hum in the background is a refrigerator. I met with McLeese and the director of operations for Pontiac Salvation Army in the food pantry. They were short-staffed that day and had to help people in the pantry and the attached shop while we spoke. Director Tina Hammer says she and McLeese both want a shelter in Pontiac, but getting one won't be easy.
even if we were able to secure a shelter today, it would probably be a 3-year plan before something was able to house anyone, which is a sad process between getting the funding and getting the building and getting the staff and everything else.
In the meantime, McLeese says the situation is bleak. Many homeless people find temporary housing with friends and family or in local motels that allow for long stays. If neither of those work out, there are Airbnbs. McLeese says these are typically outside people's budgets at around $600 per month, and even Salvation Army struggles to fund the people staying in them. But they make it work because the only other option is for people to live on the streets.
I don't think a lot of this community who has not experienced this realizes just how truly bad it is and that something has to be done about it.
There are several reasons why people are increasingly becoming precariously housed, and it's not an issue isolated to Pontiac or Central Illinois. Deb Howard with Livingston County United Way says the bottom line is that the cost of living is too high. It's gotten to the point where employed people can't pay their bills.
We have working people that are living in cars that hold jobs.
Howard says these people fall outside the income threshold for most federal aid programs. Permanent supportive housing is also not available. Howard says affordable housing is part of the solution, but it takes years to build and millions to fund.
How long can we put people up in hotels when there's no housing here? You know, it's almost like Band-Aids on everything. It's putting fires out and sticking Band-Aids on everything and no fix.
Several other counties surrounding Bloomington Normal are in the same boat as Livingston County. There are a handful of staff at a handful of agencies working to find temporary solutions to rural homelessness. Rachel Oney is one of two case managers at the Salvation Army 360 Life Center in Lincoln, which oversees 8 rural counties. None have shelters, and the closest ones are in bigger cities, 45 minutes away.
Springfield, Champaign, Decatur, Pekin, Peoria. Any direction, we're like, pick a point and you can find a big city.
Oney says the best way area service providers have found to help people who are homeless within those counties is to collaborate. She works closely with the Community Action Partnership of Central Illinois to figure out how each organization can fill in the gaps left by the other's funding limitations.
There's no reason that you should have to go to 3 different agencies to find what you're looking for. If we all know what each other are doing, then we can connect people a lot faster.
This type of collaboration also helps the organizations better combat additional rural challenges, such as a lack of transportation. It's also led to an exciting possibility for Lincoln, getting its first homeless shelter. A nonprofit is hoping to get building renovations done on the shelter in the next 3 months. At that point, it can start opening up beds to unsheltered people throughout Logan County and its neighbors. Kim Turner chairs the board of the nonprofit. She says it will work with the Salvation Army and others to coordinate wraparound services, because having a shelter is only a first step.
Obviously, having a roof over your head is extremely important, but it's not everything. It doesn't fix all of your problems. So we want to be able to address those problems for overall stability.
Brandy Gerber in Woodford County knows firsthand how hard it can be to strike that balance. She works at the county's only homeless shelter called Heart House. It has 6 rooms for women and children only. She says they don't serve men because there are women fleeing domestic violence who stay there. They do serve men, though, at Heartline, which is their financial assistance arm. Gerber says there need to be more agencies offering help.
Is there enough resources for the homeless population in Woodford County? And I'm going to say no. And it's not just a service providing shelter, it's other supportive services.
Gerber says Woodford County has to rely on Peoria often, including for mental health and public aid opportunities, since Woodford County lacks both. Peoria is about 20 miles away from Eureka, the Woodford County seat. Gerber says she understands that bigger communities such as Bloomington Normal and Peoria have more people who are homeless, but it makes the rural places like Eureka less appealing for funding.
If I presented a grant for public transportation and Peoria submitted a grant for public transportation, who would win that? It would be Peoria, because they're able to show more numbers of people that would be utilizing those services.
Gerber says getting public transportation is critical for getting people better connected to services in Woodford County, but it feels like a dream, just like Salvation Army staff in Livingston feel about getting a shelter. Matt Burgess at Home Sweet Home Ministry Shelter in Bloomington says it's up to each community to find what works for them.
One of the things that my experience has taught me is that when a community really has a will to accomplish something, they find ways to make it happen. It might not look like it does in other communities, but solutions start to rise to the surface that maybe weren't recognized before.
And agencies agree the need for solutions is clearer than ever before. They just have to get the right people on board. I'm Melissa Ellen.
Stay right here. More to come on Statewide. We'll talk about another step forward in the rise of women's sports. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It was a successful year for women's sports. The WNBA Women's Basketball League captured more fans, along with women's soccer, hockey, and more. And it's also led to the opening of women's sports bars. It started with the Sports Bra in Portland, then a bar of their own in Minneapolis. Now bars catering to women's sports fans are popping up all over. Sasha Ann Simons talked with Nora McConnell-Johnson, owner of the future Babes Sports Bar, and Heather Roberts, co-owner of the now-open Whiskey Girl Tavern, both in Chicago.
I wonder, and I'd love to hear from both of you, why you think it took us so long to get that first dedicated women's sports bar that I mentioned in Portland. You first, Nora.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is such a relationship between this whole sort of ecosystem around women's sports. So the teams, the culture, the fans, the environment, the places to watch. And I think there, it's all related. So I think it's like layered to the answer. But it's hard to find women's sports on TV, period, is sort of the first answer.
Right.
The streaming is really difficult. I'm sure Heather can talk about the challenges that they've faced at Whiskey Girl Tavern, even just putting the games on the TV. So I think that in itself like created a bit of a barrier. And then, of course, there's so much out there about like women-owned businesses, how hard it is for women to get small business loans. I think that what Jenny did in the sports bra in Portland, and like a fun fact is I went to college in Portland. Jenny worked at the college I went to, so it's like a fun little weird overlap. But Jenny really, I think, had this really breakthrough idea that to me, and I'm sure to Heather, like sounds so obvious when you think about it, but it is a innovation in what we're used to in terms of the environments we can seek out and the like what's available to us as consumers and fans of women's sports. Mm-hmm. So I think it took a while because it really is something that we had to like fight against sort of the systems to create.
Complicated, lots of layers as you laid out. What are your thoughts, Heather?
I agree with all those things. I think in general, there just aren't a lot of sports bars owned by women. And I think that women are the primary consumer still of women's sports. And, you know, again, the availability of broadcasting. And I think the demand has just increased so much that it allows for the constant programming, you mm-hmm. know, versus there'd be popular events here and there, but it wasn't enough to sustain a business mm-hmm. previously.
So how does it feel then to be part of what's now a growing movement?
We're really proud of what we've created. I think we a little bit lucked into the timing of all of it because we've had this business plan since 2018. We opened in July of 22, and we always were planning to show women's sports because my wife and I are big sports fans. But, you know, it kind of coincided pretty much exactly with when we opened and when the viewership really took off. So we've been really blessed to have such a great fan base, to have established a really strong community that loves to watch sports at our establishment. And, you know, it's been really amazing just the reception we've received.
Yeah.
I've watched many a game at Whiskey Girl Tavern.
Yes, very good. And that means it's working,
yeah.
Right? And just getting back to the feeling, you brought me back to a place, just thinking about the times that I've been at bars and actually asked for a Sky game or asked for, this is when I lived in D.C., I would ask all the time for like the women's soccer games and kind of getting sometimes met with pushback, you know, like, oh, nobody really wants to watch that right now. So I just want to hear from you what it's felt like not having spaces where you were able to watch your favorite sports team or just have that community, Nora.
Yeah, I have gotten more, lately I've gotten better reception from sort of bartenders or folks at bars to put on games. So that at least is like, it does feel like there is a bit of a shift in that.
Mm-hmm.
I will say though that I mean, I was just watching game two of the WNBA series, the finals, at a bar, a men's sort of sports bar, and the bartender, really nice about it, found a TV, put the audio on. I was really into that.
Right.
And then some guys came in, sat down the bar for me, and I could like
sense and hear the what they were saying about the fact that the women's sports were on while they were trying to watch football. And like, I think what Babe
even
is,
this year, yeah, this season when it was so hot,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I think what Whiskey Girl Tavern does, what Babe's plans to do, is to not just prioritize having those on the TV, but also creating a space where like fans of women's sports don't have to prove that they are worth being on the TVs, that it's really like what is celebrated and what is expected.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about what Whiskey Girl's been doing, but first I want to get into your plans a bit with Babe's Sports Bar at 3017 West Armitage. This is coming next year, Nora. Tell us how the journey started.
Yeah, I mean, I work in education. I have not worked behind a bar yet, but I have always been a really big women's sports, both like advocate and also player. I've played women's sports and team sports my whole life. I was the captain of the boys' soccer team in high school because I went to a small high school. And okay. So I like firsthand got to see sort of what it, like my team really respected me, but playing other schools and experiencing what some boys who like couldn't handle that felt like was really eye-opening for me as a young person. And then in college, women's sports was really a through line and sort of the community that came with my team, my rugby team in college. My co-owner, Tora, she and I were co-captains of the rugby team in college, and we really sort of got our start like in the weeds there. We led a Title IX case against our college and the athletic director for like long-time discrimination against the women's sports teams.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was just this very eye-opening moment for me as a young person of like how these institutions don't support women athletes and how important being a woman athlete has been to me my whole life. And so I like already was sort of positioned in this like it's not right out there.
Yeah. Though you don't market yourselves as a sports bar, Whiskey Girl is definitely a destination for women's sports fans in this city. So talk about how that and your neighborhood has treated you.
Yeah, we're definitely a community bar. So that's kind of our focus is to really have the bar mirror the community that we were in. We've had an amazing reception. We actually replaced a pool hall that was in our space.
Oh, really? Yeah. Tell us more about the start.
So our plan back in 2018 when we started all this was to buy an existing space, very small, and take over, something so it was simple. We could, have to reuse the license without starting from scratch. When COVID happened, we kind of backed out of that. 2 years later, our friend called us up who owned the building and said, hey, the space that's in there is moving. We'd like you to go in and open something. So we went from, probably a 1,200 square foot space to a 5,000 square foot space.
Wow. Yeah, so speaking of design and thinking about the space, Nora, you've got a specific design philosophy in mind as well for Babes.
Yeah, we're going for, I call it like vintage varsity vibe. We're going for sort of, I've been living in this sort of like futurism state lately, thinking about like what if women's sports had been on a path to be as respected and cherished as men's sports are in our society? Like what would a bar for women's sports look like in that instance? And so I think we're taking over what was a dive bar, and so we get to really sort of rip it down and make it ours with a good foundation. We're working with Siren Betty, who's a women-owned design firm that has done a lot of beautiful spaces that I love in the city, and we are working with them to really think both about the aesthetic of the space, like how do we like make it a beautiful space that really shows how these sports, watching them is a really valuable thing and should be like done nice in a nice way, but also thinking about like the actual design of the sort of structure and the way that we are like designing it for our audience. So thinking about the ways that bars have been like hostile or designed without women in mind, we're working to like make sure we're incorporating those pieces. So that's even cool. Just like lowering the bar top, it's so high right now, making sure that the seats are ergonomically designed specifically for more traditionally women bodies. We're like really trying to think about how the design of the whole space can really facilitate that.
And both of your spaces, good programming, fun programming at Whiskey Girl. So I know that you've got lots of plans in store too, but I mean, leave us with this, both of you. What do you think is the future of women's sports in Chicago? You first, Heather.
I think Chicago's lucky because we've had strong women's sports programs for years. Both of our professional, the soccer and basketball, were founding members of these leagues. But I think there's just only room to grow. I think we've seen new ownership in a lot of these teams. We've seen a lot more investment. So I think as both Chicago and nationally, as the teams get more investment, the players get more resources, the quality of the play always goes up with that investment. desire for players to play at these in these cities will improve. And so the product, even though it's great now, it's just going to keep getting better.
It's only up from here.
And it's going to keep attracting more and more fans.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we're watching this explosion, Nora, of the WNBA and the National Women's Soccer League. Popularity just going through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is happening here?
Totally. I mean, I think Chicago, just like was said, I think Chicago has the capacity to be the hub for women's sports in the country. We're about to get a professional women's rugby team too, one of the first in the country. I do think that the rebranding of the Red Stars just happened, and it's like a show's real investment in making right. that team a real mark on our map, the sky and the new practice facility. I would love to see the men's sports teams take some interest and support in this. I think that getting support from the Bulls, getting support from the Blackhawks of Fire would be awesome.
That would be key.
Would show that they are committed to this also being a hub for all sports. But yeah, I think there's so much infrastructure here. There's so much talent. I'm a Sky season ticket holder. I mean, that team is incredible. So
yeah, I'm loving the momentum.
Yeah.
Let's keep it going, right?
Yeah.
We've been talking with Heather Roberts, who's co-owner of Whiskey Girl Tavern in Edgewater, and Nora McConnell Johnson, who is working to open Babe Sports Bar in Logan Square. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Illinois lawmakers introduce thousands of bills each year. Sometimes one of them seems really popular. People fled the Capitol in support, chanting and carrying signs. Lawmakers hash it out with each other and meet with constituents. And it also gets a lot of media coverage. But even if the momentum seems there, sometimes the bill just dies, for any number of reasons. State House reporter Alex Degman gives us one example of how a bill moves and sometimes doesn't.
Invest in Kids was a way for parents to send their children to private schools, but it was ending. Here's how it worked. Illinoisans would donate money to organizations that offer scholarships, like Empower Illinois or the Big Shoulders Fund. In return, the state would offer them a 75% credit on their state income tax return, up to $7,500. Republican State Representative Blaine Willhauer calls himself an education choice kind of guy. He wanted to see an extension.
We need to stop focusing so much on how much money we're spending and what the outcome of these students are. And the outcome is abysmal, so that's why they need more opportunity.
He wasn't alone in that. Private school students and their parents flooded the state capitol, at times flirting with the fire code maximum. They sometimes chanted so loudly in the rotunda that legislators had to stop talking on the floor whenever someone opened the door. All Republicans wanted the program extended. Some Democrats wanted that too, but they wanted a few tweaks, only a temporary extension, a smaller tax credit. Governor J.B. Pritzker campaigned on ending the program, but even he changed his tune.
I have said all along that if that's what happens, I will sign that bill. If they decide not to, that's also up to the General Assembly at this point. But I will say that a lot of consideration has been given.
But then the program wasn't extended. Willhauer knew who to blame when that effort died.
The only reason that this doesn't get done, Alex, is because there are very, very powerful special interest groups that don't want it to happen. You know, the Chicago Teachers Union, the Illinois Education Association.
That may sound incendiary, but in this case, that's basically what happened. Dan Montgomery is the head of the Illinois Federation of Teachers.
Public dollars for the education of all our students should not go to private interests.
Groups like the IFT, or as Willhauer calls them, special interest groups, are constantly trying to pass or kill legislation, but they often take a different approach. Instead of flooding the Capitol, Montgomery says their coalition spent months talking with lawmakers. He calls those massive demonstrations filled with signs and chanting astroturf operations. That's where something seems like it's a grassroots effort, but it's really paid for by, you guessed it, special interests.
I thought it was despicable. They took black and brown kids out of school down to Springfield, you know, and you could see sort of the white purveyors of this scheme holding them up as props.
All this back and forth is part of lobbying, and it's a key component of why legislation sometimes fails. Chris Mooney retired from teaching political science in the University of Illinois system. He says lawmakers listen to lobbyists. A lot.
For the vast majority of legislation, they're just there to hear what the lobbyists have to say. They're not nefarious. They're part of the process. They're part of the information process.
And there are plenty of opportunities for lawmakers to talk to lobbyists. The spring session runs from January through May. That's plenty of time for a bill to get held up at one of several choke points like the House Rules or the Senate Assignments Committees.
There's a million ways to kill a bill, and only one very careful way. You got to walk through this process step by step, minefields to pass it.
In the end, a bill to extend Invest in Kids needed 71 yes votes. Even with all 40 House Republicans ready to vote yes and a few Democrats supposedly on board, House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch told reporters he didn't think that was enough, so he didn't call it. The scholarship program known as Invest in Kids was officially dead. I'm Alex Degman.
And state lawmakers return to Springfield at the state capitol next week for the start of the fall veto session. That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes. They're available where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois next week. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.